Hi everyone, I'm Heidi Rogers, and this is Tell the Others. I wanted to create a place for meaningful conversation, life lessons, and parenting hacks. Sometimes I chat to interesting people, sometimes I answer questions about parenting or life stuff, and sometimes I just rant. These episodes are filled with stories and insights that made me say, ugh, I just have to tell the others. So let's dive in to hear what we can learn today. So I think a lot of people I meet don't think that their childhood has any relevance over them today. They think that it happened in the past. I'm not in the past anymore. So why does it matter, or what does it have to do with anything? And that's a common undoing or re-educating or relearning or unlearning that I often teach people.
Yeah, I hear you. And I know you say that a lot, but how, as an adult today with a fully developed brain and going to work and paying bills and doing everything that I do, dealing with life, how can it still have an effect on who I am and how I feel?
Everything, because there's stuff that has happened in your childhood that you don't even realize how that's impacted you. So for example, your parents, right? The way that you interacted with your parents will set the template and the foundation for how you interact with legit, like, anyone in the rest of your life until you do some work or, like, personal development, get curious to figure out how you communicate and why. So the template for communication, the template for emotional regulation, the template for asking for what you need or being a martyr, silent treatment, passive aggressive, so much of who you are and how you communicate or show up at work or show up in the classroom, if you're a teacher, whatever, all of that stuff is predicated on the learning that you got in childhood. Like I always say to parents when they go, oh, I wish there was a parent school. I'm like, you did go to parent school. Your parent school is called your childhood. And I would say the same thing for people in the workplace. You did go to management school. It's called your childhood. You learned at home, consciously or unconsciously, you learned how to communicate, not communicate, people please, whatever. Does that make sense?
I think it feels like a bit of a cop-out if you're just saying, oh, it's my parents' fault and I've got no agency over it. And yeah, it feels like I'm shirking responsibility there in a way.
I get that. I think that's a really common thing. I'm not saying we're blaming your parents or we're blaming our childhoods. I'm saying that's where the understanding and the light gets illuminated to understand why you are the way that you are, or the way that you show up as a manager or as an employee comes from the learning in your childhood. I'll give you an example. So if in childhood, what's modeled for us is something like being responsible for other people's feelings matters most, and you can never upset people, and you always just have to be good and nice, obedient and compliant. That's the most important thing. If you do not do that, you will get put in timeout, hit, lose a privilege, get smacked for talking back or whatever. So if we were raised with don't ask for what you want, don't ask for what you need, or you can, but nobody cares, or nobody's going to try to help you, the child then learns to internalize, shove it down. And then that's how you would likely be as a manager, as a team member, is I'm going to shove my needs and wants down. And I'm not going to ask people for help, because what would have been conditioned into you in childhood is nobody cares or nobody's going to help you. And so by knowing that and understanding where did I learn these templates, that then enables you to be conscious in how you show up as a manager and a leader. And this is the problem that I see in every organization I've ever worked with. People are unconscious and they are not aware. They're not malicious, but they're just asleep. They're not aware of who they are, why they are, and what makes them tick and how they communicate. They don't realize that all of that is based off of the training and the modeling that they got in childhood.
I get that too, but like some people might see that as a strength, and I might see that as a strength of mine and take pride in the fact that I'm hard on myself and I set a high bar for myself for things. And that I expect the same thing from my staff members or team members who I work with or people within my family. I feel like that's a little bit of a strength, and I wear that as almost a badge of pride. I'm hard on myself. I work hard and I expect others to do the same.
And that I think is super common. I think especially for dudes, that's super common to be very hard on themselves and have a very high work ethic and high standard But that's like, we got to differentiate then. Are we talking about like perfectionism or are we talking about healthy striving? And I think they get very blurred. And I think that a lot of times what you're referring to, you tell yourself is healthy striving, but what it really is perfectionism. And then I guess the better question is, how do you respond? How do you treat yourself when you make a mistake? And that will help me discern, I think, which one you're talking about. So if you make a mistake at work, how do you treat yourself and how do you respond?
Well, I'm cranky at myself because I'm better than that and I shouldn't be making mistakes or failing. It's something that I missed and I've got to do better next time, but I might be happy with myself.
I think that's the most normal response, I think, or the average response. I think the natural response that everyone would probably say something like that. And so then I assume you have that part or that voice that then comes in and says, yeah, you should have done it different or you should have done it better. Or what was the thing? I can't remember the thing you said about how you would have done it different.
It's not good enough. It's not up to my standard. And I have higher standards than that. And if I fall below those, then I feel like I'm not being true to myself, that I'm not reaching those. I'm not living up to the ideals and values that I have for myself.
So it's rooted in, I'm not good enough. And so then as soon as you say that, I know we're not talking about healthy striving. We're talking about perfectionism and we're talking about it not being good enough. And then I go, that's not sustainable. And also that's not having any compassion on yourself. And that's the thing that I find a lot of times, especially with dudes, this conversation about being hard on myself. And I view it as I need that voice. The critic helps me get stuff done. The critic helps me be productive. And I'm so ambitious and I'm a successful entrepreneur and rah, 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 because I have that critic in my head whipping me and making me work hard. And I just roll my eyes in my head thinking, you're making it so much harder for yourself. And you actually could be far more successful, productive, crushing it. Your business could be making 30,000 times more or whatever if you stopped doing that. But that's what's hard, is to try to convince people of that, because what you don't see is that voice plays a protective role. And so that perfectionist, that part of you that is, you need to do it better, you need to be good enough, that actually comes from childhood. And that's actually rooted in your childhood. This isn't unique to you. This is all of us have that part that we got in childhood that taught us then, if you fill in the blank, get good grades, clean up your room, are skinny, are athletic, are pretty, whatever it is, if you are these things, then you will have my love, my approval, my connection, right? The parents are communicating inadvertently. They're not malicious people, but most of our parents were communicating to us inadvertently that my love for you is actually conditional. If you are obedient and compliant and you do what I say, then I will, or what I want you to, how I want you to be, then I will be connected to you and you'll have my approval and we'll be good. Fast forward then to now, how that impacts you as an adult is you have that same tape playing that I have to be good enough. I have to be fill in the blank. And that's then what will earn my love and approval and whatever from society. And then you take that too from your family, from your workplace, from wherever. But it's like we get that template on healthy striving or perfectionism or being good enough or whatever from our childhood. Inadvertently, again, we don't realize that's what's happening. And so the key here is to realize that's what's happening and that I'm using this old tape that used to keep me safe. The critic and that perfectionistic whipcracker of do it right was right. If I didn't do that stuff, I fell out of favor with my parents, and that doesn't make you safe and that doesn't make you thrive and survive your childhood. So this is where it gets tricky and why that part of you that says, no, I need that voice. That voice makes me amazing and whatever. It's true because that was true when we were little. But what time is it? What year is it? I don't need to rely on that voice anymore. I'm safe now. I'm an adult. I have my own bank account, my own house, blah, 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 blah. I'm not beholden and dependent on the connection with my parents and being safe with them. And so if I can access more compassion for myself, that actually frees up my nervous system and my brain to feel safe. And if my nervous system and my brain feel safe, I can think more with the cool parts of my brain rather than just the fight, flight, survival parts of my brain, where when you're whipping yourself and being hard on yourself and I'm better than that's actually what you're doing is you're like shooting yourself in the foot and you're making yourself less productive because you're being so hard on yourself. You're likely to make more mistakes and you're likely to not be as efficient. Whereas if you're safe and in flow and feeling good about what you're doing and I'm loved no matter what, if that's what's happening in your head, then you will be better at whatever it is you're doing.
Yeah, look, I can intellectually get that in a way, but it also just seems like you're buying into fairies and rainbows and let's all just be happy and we'll forget the values and the rules we live by and what we're striving for. We'll just be easy on ourselves. I would worry that if I didn't have that person cracking the whip and driving me, that I would go backwards in life and I wouldn't be happy with myself.
Yeah. And that's the most common thing I would hear whenever I start this conversation with someone is that, wait, what? If you take the whip cracker, the critic out of my head, I'm not going to get anything done. I'm going to sit on the couch and eat bonbons all day and not be productive. And to that, I'm like, well, of course you're going to say that. Because the part that's whipping you, the part that's critical, is little. That's a little boy or a little girl. That's a little part of us. That's a young part, probably under 10. Because that's when we learned. I'm loved when I look like this, act like this. But most of us, it's behave like this. And usually that's compliance. If I listen, I'm compliant, I'm obedient, I people please, I don't disappoint, I do as I'm told, I'm safe and don't have needs, don't have wants, certainly don't express them, and make the grownups happy. That's what most of us are conditioned to believe. So that part, the critic, so many people, I think the critic gets such a bad rap. The critic is so often, you hear personal development people say, ignore the critic and you need to learn to tell the critic to F off and you need... No, I totally disagree. I think we need to hug the critic. And I think we need to bring the critic bring it in, hug the critic and say, hey, how old are you? When did you get born? When did you get hired in this organization of this internal boardroom? Because most of them would say, oh, I remember. I remember when I was 6, that was the first time that I felt I had to be or do a certain thing to receive my parents' love, affection, approval, whatever, to be in the good books was when I got a trophy or when I got an A or was a certain weight or wore a pretty dress or whatever. So when you recognize that the critic's birthplace actually comes from a place of protection and trying to keep you safe psychologically and emotionally and to keep the connection safe between you and your parents when you were little or your caregivers, whoever they were, that's when you realize the critic is actually just trying to keep me safe and the critic is actually really little. And so then when you realize that, you are then able to meet the critic with what the critic really needs, which is compassion, empathy, love, validation, and like a reminding, sweetheart, you're human. You are worth more than this. You are worth more than your appearance. You are worth more than your performance in this game or this stage production. How you performed on this project or this meeting or this whatever, you are worth more than that. And so when the critic tries to say, you did that wrong and you shouldn't have done it this way and you're better than that, I view it like literally I hold in my mind like a 5 or 6 year old version of me, I see her face and go, oh, sweetheart, you think it's the 80s and you think that you need to be perfect to receive the love of those around you. You don't, because you're in your 40s now and you're safe and you're loved and you are accepted as you are. But that piece of what I just said, you're saved and you're loved and accepted as you are, a lot of people would go, that's not true. Because there's work to be done in that internal boardroom, in that internal experience, where I then give myself the love and acceptance and appreciation and validation and compassion. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. It all sounds pretty soft still. But okay, say I buy into this and I'm going, yay, I'm going to be so happy with myself. And I've got 15 different parts of me who are hanging around in there and talking and somebody's driving. What good does it do for me to pretend I'm talking to myself when I'm 6?
I don't know if it's gendered, but it definitely feels like men are much more conditioned by society to shut off from that introspection. I think you guys are from when you're really little, from when you're first told you're not allowed to cry and to separate yourself from your feelings. I think it happens a long time ago. So what is the good that it does? If you want to start with the performance part, because I know a lot of men are really keen to hit their KPIs and perform as best they can, optimal performance and work and life and marathons. I'll start there. If your nervous system and your brain feel safe and regulated, which means calm, if you're in that state, you can think clearly, you can act, you can execute, you can implement, you can perform optimally. As soon as I put a gun to your head and I tell you, you better not screw this up. Everyone's watching. Better make everyone proud. There's a lot riding on this. Your brain goes offline, and not because you're choosing that. And this is like something you would see happen a lot in the military, is a conditioning and a training to when my nervous system feels unsafe because I'm in Afghanistan or bombs are going off around me. I need to try to put that to the side and then focus on the task at hand and execute my mission. But that's training, and that's years and years of experience. And that's a legit thing in the military to be trained to learn how to tune that out, right? Most of us have not done that kind of training. And so the average person, when the internal voice is loud and whipping you and critical, it throws the whole system off. So your ability to think sharp, make good decisions, plan creatively, like use all of your brain and all of the magic that your brain has, you can't. Because as soon as you start whipping yourself and speaking unkindly to yourself, your brain, without you trying, so this isn't, people think it's so much more conscious or I'm choosing. No, there's a physiological response that will take over. There's a physiological hijacking that will overpower the whole thing. This is like saying, if I have a glass of water, I'm going to tell myself I don't have to pee. And I'm going to be strong-willed and I'm going to have willpower and I'm not going to have to pee. Bullshit. That doesn't work like that. You will get to a point, however much you drink, that you will have to pee. As hard as you try to meditate and do yoga and talk yourself out of having to pee, you will have to do it. Same thing with the way that we speak to ourselves. It will impact you on an execution level of how you execute and how you show up in your relationships, in your workplace, wherever. If you internally do not feel safe because you are so critical on yourself and hard on yourself, you will be inadvertently sending your nervous system and your brain into a dysregulated stress response. So it's like putting a gun to your head or the drill sergeant yelling in your head, what's wrong with you? You're not supposed to do it this way. You should have had it done by now. That tone makes the whole system go not an optimal best performance. And that's not what you want. So if we started the conversation by you saying, Heidi, I want to achieve my best performance at work, which I think is what a lot of people would say of why they get into personal development, is to be best performance. We have to start there. And so that's why I always say self-compassion is the foundational, fundamental piece we have to start with, because the whipping yourself and being hard on yourself undermines all the work I try to do with people. So I always will start with self-compassion, because anything I try to build as a therapist, anything I try to build on top of that is just going to get undermined by the critic and the perfectionist and the whippers. But sort of circling back to all of this, or tying it all together, it's first realizing where that voice comes from and realizing that the critic or the perfectionist or the top performer is actually a younger part of ourselves, usually under 10, but can also be a teenager, that was trained in those beliefs, that got those tapes, that got those stories embedded in, that this is what will keep me safe emotionally, psychologically, socially with my environment, is if I behave this way. And most of us forget to upgrade the tapes and realize I am a grown-ass adult. I do not need to subscribe to this crap anymore. It is okay if I'm compassionate on myself and empathetic and speak kindly to myself. I'm human. Everyone makes mistakes. I've been juggling a lot. When you speak to yourself like that, you then free up the brain and the nervous system to not be hijacked in a stress response and to execute using all the brain and be your best self.
I'd never thought of it like that, admittedly. And it seems like it makes sense. It's a logical premise that you've got there. What is difficult, or what I think I'd find difficult, and probably a lot of other people, would be taking that leap of faith and taking the first steps, because you don't know what's going to happen on the other side by letting your critic, or making a critic, sit in the back room, or hugging your critic, or however you want to put it. particularly when it feels like that is the core thing that makes you safe and that drives you and that leads to your achievement and the relationships you have at home. And how do you get over that? And how do you get, would you get started if you wanted to begin practicing self-compassion and to change things? Like, I can understand, yes, I can recognize that this comes from a place where I was a little boy and where people, little boys and little girls, but you know, what do we do with that then?
Great question. I think that is the most common, obvious next piece to this. And I think by articulating that, what you're also identifying is the fear, right? The fear that the critic has of losing their job. And anytime we have a part that is a protector, and this language is internal family systems, IFS, Richard Schwartz, his whole life's work, if anyone listening wants to learn more about it, which is the language of parts and different people in our head, and protectors are play a pivotal role, because protectors are usually the ones that stop us from change and stop us from exploring new ways of being, because that's their whole job, is to protect and keep the whole boardroom and the whole team safe. And so in this context of, I hear like what I just heard you say is, you sold me. The whole compassion thing sounds cool, but where do I start? Because what is happening is a protector part, that little boy who's protected you for decades, he's saying, I'm sorry, am I losing my job? No thanks. I'm here to be safe, and I can't fathom the idea of me not being here because I am what have got us to this point. So don't you dare fire me. So that's where you will often see, as a therapist, where I often will see resistance to, I throw an idea out and then the client might say, that's ridiculous. There's no way I'm going to be doing that. And then I'll say, oh, look at that. Look at that resistant. Wow, we really just found a resistant part there. And I immediately know, you just identified a protector. So anytime we have resistance to change, it's a protector. So what your brain just showed us is, the thought of being compassionate to myself doesn't feel safe.
It feels weak.
Yeah. And I think that is common. I think a lot of people would say that. But if we know that the way that I'm speaking to myself and being harsh on myself is not actually serving me and causing me suffering, either I think most of the time would be in my stress levels or my anxiety levels. I think if people can be honest with themselves and go, yeah, my stress levels or my anxiety levels are higher than I would want them to be. If it was a dial, yes, I would like to turn it down. Then that's my in, I think. If someone says, yes, I would like to turn the dial down, then I go, okay, so let's try this little exercise. I'm serious, like right now, do you want to do a little exercise with me?
Yeah, all right, let's give it a crack.
You're a good sport. So where I start often with clients when I am going down this sort of path is, I would say, I want you to think of just a low level problem, okay? A low level, not a 10 out of 10 trauma, but like a 1 out of 10, 2 out of 10 thing that's bothering you or frustrating you, where you feel the critic is right up in there and criticizing or saying stuff about how you should have done this differently or better or whatever. And just notice, and if it helps you to close your eyes, to visualize the boardroom and to go into that real imaginative space. If not, keep your eyes open. Pick a spot in the room to just fix your gaze and think about that problem. And I want you to think about it as like board member apart saying, so if it's Project X, board member is sitting there going, we really screwed it up, guys. I really wish I hadn't handled it like that or whatever. You got that? So just hold that in your mind, that part. And then I want you to visualize the critic or the whatever part it is that's critical of that. Is that business owner me? Is that dad me? Who is that part that has critic in front of it? So like critical dad, critical business owner, critical fitness, health levels, whatever. And having them blast and whip, right? So just visualize that interaction between the two of them. And then notice what it feels like in your body. Okay, so if you are feeling this as the I made the mistake or whatever, just notice in your body. So this is like the sensations, the tension, the tightness, the tingling. What does it feel like as you're receiving this blast from that critical part? Just notice that. And then I'm going to say to that part, hey, critical part, could you just humor me and let me run a little experiment here? Could you step to the side? And I promise I'm not going to overwhelm you. Just step to the side. And I want to bring in ideal loving parent me and old wise me. And so I want you to just visualize in this board, ideal loving parent, old wise me. So whatever you look like with gray hair, gray beard, old dude. And then the most perfect parent, whatever that looks like, visualize those two. And then I want those two to go sit next to the part that's feeling like he failed and he made a mistake. And they're going to sit however feels. So that could be they rub his back, they just stand next to him, they sit down on the floor. I don't know. Your brain knows what's the most comforting. Have them sit down next to this part who feels like he made a mistake. And then I'm going to feed them some lines and then let your brain throw some out. But I want them to be saying something to this part that's compassionate. Something like, hey, you're human in the scheme of things. If we zoom out and look at all of life, it's probably not as big a deal as you think it is. And I've made lots of mistakes like that in my life and my career. It makes sense why it's bothering you so much. I think it's totally understandable why you're upset about this. It is frustrating. So we're having them validate and empathize and extend compassion. What else do you think are some phrases, if you channel those compassionate voices, what are some other things you think you could hear them saying to that part that are compassionate?
I think you just talking through that with me made me realize something about the critical board member is that I almost enjoy the feeling that comes about when that board member is raging, the feeling of adrenaline and sort of anger at myself. And it's almost like a high, right? That it's a low and a high together. It doesn't make you feel good, but it also makes you feel good too, because you're riding a wave and you've got that energy and the rage and the anger that comes along with it. And that feels like it's, again, something that it feels like I enjoy to an extent, even though I know and I can feel it hurting me at the same time.
I want to address that in a second, but can you think of what you would have the compassionate part say? What would old wise me, an ideal living parent, what would they say? Do they have a mantra, like a one sentence-y sort of thing of what they were saying to that part who's made the mistake or who was being hard on themselves?
The world's not going to end if you take it a little bit easier on yourself. If you zoom out and you don't get so stuck in the weeds and stuck in the day-to-day and expectations of this and that, I think it's time to, you can afford to loosen up a little bit. I've been there, I've done it, and it's a lot healthier.
And so then as you just said that, and if you want to stay with your eyes closed and in that space, what does it feel like to hear that? And I just want to highlight the difference. There's a difference between hearing and receiving. So you might hear it. I hear those voices saying, it's okay to take your foot off the gas. It's okay to zoom out. You don't need to be so hard on yourself. But then receiving it, embodying it, that often takes time and that often takes practice. And so sometimes when we're starting the self-compassion process, and if this is all new to people, which a lot of times I find it is, and to that I always say, that's okay if this sounds weird and feels weird. Of course it will feel weird because you've gone decades without rolling this way, right? So your brain is going to be a little bit like, this feels odd. But that doesn't mean it's wrong, and that doesn't mean I should stop. It's a great indication to get curious about, this is weird. This is different. And what does that feel like? So if you reflect upon what it feels like in your body to hear that kindness and that gentleness and that compassion, what does it feel like in your body as you hear that stuff?
I definitely notice the physical sensation of a softening at my core when I was speaking, when the old wise me and the sort of kind parent me were talking. And it's a foreign type of a feeling, and it feels, it just feels strange, doesn't it? It feels like you're trying to put someone else's shoes or jeans on. It doesn't quite fit. I could see myself trying it again and again. It'd be a matter of repetition, but then how do I keep myself on the ball? Because I'm sure it's going to be easy just to go back to the old habits, particularly given how foreign it feels when, you know, you're talking to yourself like that, a nice way.
Yeah. I think there has to come a point for all of us where if I'm going to change behavior, there has to be a bit of a why. And you got to get clear on your values and your why am I doing this? Because if it's just because Heidi said so, or my wife said so, or I read it in a book or Tony Robbins, like that's not sufficient. There needs to be more motivation. I think two things, we need to have a real good why when we're trying to change behavior, quit smoking, stop drinking, whatever. I think then another part of that is you need to understand where this comes from, why I've been doing this. So it's like why in another way, why I do this. And then the other part I think is we are most likely to change behavior when we're trying to avoid pain. We're not so motivated by pleasure. We're more motivated by avoiding pain. And we're designed like that. You can't really compete with that. And so I guess it's reframing that this voice, this critical protector, actually causes me suffering and actually makes me be really grumpy or hard on my kids or hard on my team, or it's making me not perform at my best level as a manager or whatever. Like you got to get some buy-in from the board members in your head of why we want to change and have the critic be less loud. And then another part of that, I think, is whenever you're talking about changing behavior, you're usually talking about messing with the protector. Protectors don't like to lose their jobs. They don't like lateral movement. They do not like any shift. They like to be a protector and they like to run it how they've run it. So when we're talking about this and saying, I want to have the critic sit back in his seat and not run so many meetings and talk so much, I think first we got to look at, okay, how old is this guy? How old is this critic, this perfectionist who's whipping me and saying, do it faster, you know, that guy, who is that? And usually people will say a little age, a high school or a little kid age. And then I invite people to look at, how does that feel to know that a six-year-old is running your organization? What do you think about that? Would you rather have the 15-year-old? Or the six-year-old run the organization? Or would you rather have you, adult, fully developed brain, decades of life experience, work experience, relationship experience, right? All of this knowledge, would you rather have that guy running it and not being so motivated by fear and staying safe and making your parents happy? Do you know what I mean? And that's the thing, is we don't upgrade that tape. We often don't realize that's what I'm actually doing. So if you then get clear on, okay, where does this come from? Why does this protector part exist, this perfectionist or critical part? Then you're able to look at more, wait a second, what role do I actually want you to play? And instead of viewing it as I'm getting rid of this part, no, the critic is always allowed a seat at the table for sure, because it's a little part. I don't want to fire the little six-year-old in you and tell the little six-year-old that you have to wait outside the boardroom and you're not welcome here. That's not cool. That's not compassionate. So instead I go, oh, hey, critic, you're a little six-year-old boy who's trying to stay safe socially at home, win the favor of your peers and your parents and whatever. And I have a lot of compassion for you because I see how hard you've worked to keep the organization safe. And you've done such a great job. But what we're realizing now is what year it is and where the organization is at. We don't need to be so harsh on the whole team. And we've actually brought in some other people who could help you maybe find some other stuff, because you are so valuable to the team and you have such a great eye for detail and you have such a great work ethic and you are so ambitious and you are so perseverant and persistent. And we love that. And those are great traits. But that whipping, and what often happens when I have this conversation with clients and I say, and I then give over to the critic and say, how do you feel and what do you want? 9 times out of 10, they say, I'm tired and I'm exhausted and I'm sick of whipping and I'm six or I'm 15 and I really just want to go play with my friends and I don't like being so much pressure and responsibility on me. And the number one word I hear is I'm exhausted. And so then I say, yeah, so what is it that you want to do? And I ask the protector, I ask the critic, I ask that part, what do you want to do? And they say, I want to go play. Awesome. Can we visualize that? And then I would guide you through a, how do you want to visualize? So it's not, I'm not firing, I'm not releasing. I'm releasing that part to go do what it really wants to do, which is be a little kid or a teenager and not have so many adult worries. And then reminding that protector part, it's safe to do so because I have this whole team here that can manage the stuff you were managing. And then the protector will feel like it's safer to step away. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it definitely makes sense. It brings up like a couple of questions and I'll just try to make them brief just because I don't want to confuse the topics. But one, I'd feel like potentially I'll be losing part of my identity and who I am, who I've been from zero until today. And it's okay, let's just change your entire identity and we will no longer be you. So who am I without being me? That feels like that's saying goodbye to me. And maybe then I could ask you a question about the why and how to get to the why. But that, I guess that first part of the question is like, will I disappear? Who am I without that?
Love that question. That is such a good question. And I love that too, because we talked a little bit about what we were going to talk about in this conversation, but that one we didn't even list. And I think that's such a great conversation because what you just alluded to, or what you just don't realize that you just revealed, is that you believe that being harsh on yourself and critical of yourself is the real you. So to say, who am I without being me? Wow, how revealing, right? That the thought is, the story is, that me being harsh on myself and critical and a perfectionist and cracking that whip and yelling and being that drill sergeant, that's me. Totally disagree. I don't think any of us come out that way. I think we are conditioned to that. I don't think you take any one-year-old or two-year-old, you take any pure little blank canvas, and how do they act when someone makes a mistake? That's okay. They give you a hug. They pat their little friend on the back. How many of us screw up with our kids and we say or do the wrong thing, and they say, that's okay, and they are so forgiving and so gentle and so kind and so patient. We do not come out being harsh. We do not come out being critical and tough. We are taught that. That we are taught that and we are modeled that. So when you say, who am I without being me? I would gently challenge that and say, how do you know that the person you are speaking of and describing and the board members that you currently have, how do you know that's really you? And to that, I would say, you don't. They are hired. They are people you created in a response to your environment to survive. And that's not unique to you. That's me. That's everyone. And so all of the parts, all the voices that we have in our head come from somewhere. But the ones that I know for sure we all came with is love, compassion, connection, empathy, gentleness. All of those beautiful traits is what in the pure innocence of babies and children that they get it. And every year as a kid gets older, they lose that. And to me, they get further and further away of who they really are and who they came to this world as. And so to me, all of this work and all of this stuff that I talk about and teach is all really an effort to bring you back to the beginning and bring you back to where you started and to who you were before the world, parents, family, society messed us up, teachers, coaches, whatever. We all got it when we were little and then we lost it. When you were little, you would have had no problem wearing a Spider-Man costume to the grocery store and doing cartwheels and singing from the top of your lungs and being your authentic, vulnerable self. And then you stopped at some point because someone brought it into your awareness that wasn't cool or you were going to be laughed at or whatever. Anytime you had big feelings, anger, sad, whatever, you were taught by someone around you to put it away or it makes things harder for you. So the best question to ask, is it working? Is it working right now? So you have this whole thing of I've been doing this, doing life this way, of being hard on myself and whipping myself and I can't fathom another way. And to that I say, is it working? Just if going to the casino 7 nights a week or drinking a whole slab of beer or 5 bottles of wine, I don't give a shit. Is it working for you? And for a lot of people, they can, and it's working and they don't have any complaints. Well, rad, I don't have a problem with it either. What's broken? And so if you look at what's broken or you look at what's not working, or maybe I'm not satisfied with, or it feels out of alignment, or my partner has a problem with it or whatever, then that's what's, my kids have a problem. Then that's what to me is not working. And so then that's where you get curious. And then you go, my stress levels are really high. I'm anxious all the time, or whatever it is. I see now I need to maybe look at my self-compassion because I'm so tough on myself and it's not working and I don't like living this way anymore. And then I go, ah, so there's some of your buy-in. There's some of your why. We also have done that little reveal of like, where does this actually come from? It comes from childhood. It comes from a protector. So can I then maybe try? And I think whenever we change behavior, it's 3 steps forward, 2 steps back. It's not one trajectory upward. I actually don't trust it whenever someone is just no days of relapse. I don't think that's actual change. I think actual change is 3, 2, 3, 2. And then checking in with someone, a therapist, a friend, or whatever, to help hold you accountable to this thing that you're trying to change and helping you stay on track. And that's part of what I like about the programs and stuff that I do is you get that accountability piece in changing your behavior built in.
Yeah, I think that the penny dropped a little bit there in terms of trying to discover my why and finding it difficult initially to say, okay, this is why I would want to make that change and hold myself accountable. And it's, I was thinking, do you have to hit rock bottom first? Because I know with previous big life changes, I've had to hit rock bottom or get close to, and that has had rocket fuel and lit the fire under me for change. But I think that part of what we've just discussed about asking the question, what's not working, I think that can be, that feels to me like it's a good place to start in terms of finding your why. And then also not just looking inside yourself for what's not working, because I don't know what's normal for other people. I don't know what's possible beyond what I feel and my life experience right now. So I guess if it's impacting other people in my life, or if I'm getting negative vibes, interactions with other people, or things aren't necessarily going the way I want in those aspects, then maybe I could start looking at those more deeply and they could potentially inform the why, because I don't want to hit rock bottom before I have enough fuel to be able to make this change.
And I think most people unfortunately do that. And everyone, whenever I meet a client for the first time and it's our first session, and I'll say, what brings you in? Where should we begin? It's usually a lot of tears and a lot of, I've hit rock bottom in some area of my life, or something big has happened, or I have a piece of suffering. There is some suffering that I'm experiencing. There's a pain right now. And do you remember how I said a minute ago, we're usually more motivated by pain than we are by pleasure? It's a thing. That's how our brain is wired. That's literally how we are wired to be, is to avoid discomfort, avoid pain, avoid uncertainty, and to gravitate more towards comfort, certainty, and control. So to answer that, how you find your why most often is going to be driven by pain. But I hear you. If you're outside of a season of suffering, I call it, if you're outside a season of suffering and this is resonating and you're like, okay, I want to do it. I don't want to be in pain when I'm making these changes. That's great. And that is often not as motivating as pain. Pain is the best motivator, unfortunately. But just the consciousness, you can do a lot of growth and healing and evolution in having conscious awareness. Ah, this is what's happening. Or this is how I want to be. This is how I want to show up as a dad, a father, a partner, an employee, a manager. This is how I want to show up. And so you can get conscious about that. But I think what I like to do, and this maybe sounds a bit morbid or a bit weird, is I like to imagine the pain. And there's a lot of people in the personal development space that do this. They do some sort of exercise where you visualize and get really still and imaginative and imagine whatever the worst case scenario is, or you imagine the pain. And because the brain is so amazing, you can do a pretty good job of making yourself cry and forget about it. But you imagine the pain. And so it's like you create it in your mind and then you go, that's what I'm going to drive myself towards. So a lot of times when I do this with parents, where I will steer them is, what's it going to be like when your kids are 35 and they want nothing to do with you? They don't want you to look after the grandkids. They don't want to spend holidays with you. It's really hard to get them to even return your calls or spend a meal with you. What's that going to be like? And they'll go, horrible. That would make me really sad. And then I'll go, okay, the path that you're on right now, you are headed straight towards that because you never validate your kids' experience. You don't empathize. You're very hard on them and blah, blah, blah. And a lot of times that's when it clicks and they go, oh. And sometimes they'll go, I think you're wrong. And I'll go, bye, have a nice life. But most of the time they'll hear me and go, I'm taking that on board. And I'll say, you need to change the stories up here, the physiological state of your body. We got to change what's happening in your body and in your mind if you want your behavior and the rest of your life to change. Does that make sense?
I think I've got a lot of homework to do.
It's a big conversation. Self-compassion, like I said, it's foundational. It's the bottom piece of the whole thing. If that resonated, the conversation on self-compassion, for those of you listening, I would say to go to the show notes or HeidiRogers.com and sign up for the self-compassion webinar. It's free and you can learn more about this. It's a really valuable training. There's a lot of value in it. You could learn more. And because I say this is the foundational piece, this is really something you need to get your head around first before you want to change other aspects of your behavior or you want to improve things in your life. This is really a foundational place to start. And if you like the self-compassion webinar, then you can go even further and we can learn more together and you can do one of my programs. But it's definitely a really great place to start.
If you're a parent or a professional who works with children and you want my help in improving things with the kiddos in your life, or if you're simply a human being feeling kind of stuck and maybe kind of overwhelmed, my online programs have lots of resources, transformative content, one-on-one coaching, group coaching, and a supportive community. If you want to learn more, just go to HeidiRogers.com. All right, friends, thank you as always for tuning in today. Our time is our most precious asset, so I truly appreciate you sharing your time with me. I'll see you right back here for the next episode of Tell the Others.